fasciste, drot helvete, 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 fasciste, drot helvete. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Today I would like to talk about Scandinavian people. Well, I suppose more specifically Swedish people. But the question that's been on my mind for a while is, why is it that Scandinavians are so woke? Why is it that Swedes are so woke? Are there in fact sort of ethnic differences in the propensity to virtue signal and to be woke? And if this is the case, why is it, and what exactly is going on? Now, a number of you have asked me to do this video, and so I look forward to doing so. So I think the fundamental issue relates to two separate strategies by which that work at the group level. Remember, we've talked before on this show about how you can pass on your genes. You pass on your genes at the individual level, you pass on your genes at the kin level by investing in your kin, and you pass on your genes at the group level. So there is battles between groups, there is fights between groups, and the groups which win those battles, which triumph in those battles, they dominate, and they are more likely to pass on their genes and contribute to the future. Now, computer models, of course, have shown that the optimal strategy for passing on your genes is what's known as the ethnocentric strategy. That is to say that you are highly internally cooperative and you are highly externally violent. And computer models have shown, when that is contrasted with various different other possible strategies, it is those that are high in ethnocentrism which will tend to dominate the grid. So the most successful group strategy is to be highly, highly ethnocentric. And those kinds of groups are also going to be highly closely related to each other. Now, another strategy is what I've called, and I look at this in my book, Race Differences in Ethnocentrism, is what I call the genius strategy. Now, this is the idea that the group actually is relatively low in ethnocentrism. They are not particularly ethnocentric, but they are high in openness. They are prepared to cooperate with foreign groups. They are not they're not so negatively ethnocentric. They may be positively ethnocentric, but they're not negatively ethnocentric. Now, if they cooperate with other groups, it allows them to trade. It allows them to pick up new ideas from those groups. It allows them to expand. And so this can actually be quite a useful strategy. It allows their gene pool to get larger, and this allows them to throw up geniuses. Now, what are geniuses? Geniuses are people that come about by genetic chance, basically, and they combine, that they are a function of a relatively large gene pool, and they combine outlier high IQ with moderately low agreeableness, so moderately low cooperation, and moderately low conscientiousness. And this means that they don't care about offending people, and they can think outside the box and come up with original ideas, and they're clever enough to come up with those ideas. And so the group that follows this strategy produces geniuses, and then they come up with brilliant ideas. This allows them, like new weapons or whatever, this allows them to dominate other groups in warfare, and therefore expand further, and then dominate other groups and expand further. And so actually they're winning the battle of group selection, despite being moderately low in ethnocentric traits. But they've got these geniuses which they produce, which allow them to dominate other groups. So you have those two fundamental strategies. And this genius strategy works as long as the level of ethnocentrism of the group that is operating the genius strategy doesn't fall too low. And what will tend to keep its level of ethnocentrism relatively high is, A, you will be under harsh conditions of group selection, which means that, you know, that there will be fighting, there'll be war, there'll be violence, there'll be stress. And we know that stress tends to elevate religiousness and make people religious. And B, the religion will tend to take that which is for the good of the group, take that which is adaptive, such as an optimum level of ethnocentrism, and make that into the will of God. And so you have this genius strategy combined with an optimum level of religiousness, which means that the group, although it's high in kind of, it's not particularly ethnocentric, it's high in kind of generalised altruism, trust of foreign groups, you know, the ability and desire to cooperate with foreigners, this never gets so far as to allow itself to be invaded or to think of itself as useless or to think of itself as not worth preserving, because there is that fundamental religiousness that's always there. Now, those are the two strategies. Now, if we want to understand the way Scandinavia works and why Scandinavia is so woke, we have to understand its position
position on a spectrum between these two strategies. So a group that has a highly ethnocentric strategy would be a group let's say the Japanese. So the Japanese are evolved to an extremely harsh ecology, which is extremely predictable. They're what we call K strategists. We are all on a spectrum of R strategy, which is an unstable, unpredictable ecology where you can be wiped out at any minute. Consequently, you just live fast and die young and hope to pass on your genes as quickly as possible. Because you live fast and die young, this doesn't militate in favour of cooperation, because if you cooperate with somebody, you might never be paid back, because they could just be wiped out. So you live fast and die young, and that's it. As we move along to a more stable and more predictable ecology, then of course it becomes a lot harsher, a lot more difficult to survive. And so this militates in favour of taking energy away from simply having lots of sex and hoping that some of your offspring survive, because if you do that in a harsh ecology, they could all just die, to being highly adapted to the ecology and adapting your offspring to the ecology and raising your offspring so that they're adapted to the ecology so that they're more likely to survive. So you take energy away from sex and whatever, and testosterone basically, and you put it into nurture. So the nature of the people starts to change. The people start to become more cooperative. They start to become more agreeable. They start to become more conscientious. They start to become... they start to get very tightly structured, bonded groups, because if you're part of such a group like that in a harsh ecology, you're more likely to survive. Now, the harsher the ecology is, the more you have to be very, very strongly adapted to that ecology genetically, and any deviation from that ecology simply cannot be tolerated. And that's what you get with the Japanese and the Chinese. You get a relatively small gene pool, which means that any deviation from the ecology can't be tolerated. Now, that militates against genius, because genius is a function of outlier high IQ, and outlier high IQ combined with personality traits that don't often go with it, basically moderately psychopathic personality traits, and that means that's not as likely to happen because the gene pool is so small, because they're so up against it. The second reason is that the flip side of these geniuses, what are geniuses? They're highly intelligent, sort of moderate psychopaths, basically. That's what they are, but they have good benefits for the group. The flip side of that is going to be low IQ criminals, who are going to be very damaging to the coherence of the society and the ability of the society to survive. And that is so appalling and so dreadful and so intolerable when you're up against it, like the Japanese were historically, that it outweighs the positive side of genius. And so therefore you don't get geniuses, you don't get high levels of per capita genius in these kinds of societies. And you get people that are also, for that reason, very, very high in conscientiousness, very, very high in conformism. They don't have many people that are going to question the way things are and question the society. Very, very conformist, extremely conformist, highly, highly ethnocentric and whatever. Now, of course, there's other aspects. There's virtue and whatever, and morality becomes important in such societies as well. But that's the extreme. At the other extreme, you get something like Africa or whatever, where there's no way they can develop a much of a genius sort of culture, really, because the ability to the IQ is just high enough, basically. And so then you get a Goldilocks zone between the two, which is quite ethnocentric but is open to this genius culture. And I've argued in other videos that seems to be the British. So, you know, the British are that Goldilocks zone. As you move towards Scandinavia, they do seem to be higher in ethnocentrism. But even so, they do operate, compared to somewhere like Japan, a relative genius strategy. Now, what that means is that the ethnocentric dimension to society is less important, is to some extent less important than the operation of this genius strategy. And what that in turn means is they are open to outsiders, they are open to new things, they are open to new ideas, they are open to trade, they are open to foreigners. You know, they are not that high in ethnocentrism. Now, then it gets interesting, because if that happens, if you create a relatively ethnically and genetically diverse society, then how can you hold the society together? How can you persuade people to cooperate with each other when they're not particularly genetically similar? Because the evidence is that we tend to cooperate with people that are more genetically similar. How can you persuade them to cooperate? Right. Well, then religion and a religion based around morality starts to become extremely important. So it's been shown that once once you get these kinds of complex societies that are genetically and ethnically diverse, then you start to get the presence of moral gods. And morality becomes absolutely, and the presence of moral gods and this religion based around morality starts to become extremely important to holding the society together and to persuading people to cooperate. And if people follow the same moral gods that you follow, then that becomes an insurance policy that you can trust them and you can cooperate. And so it helps to maintain this ethnocentric society that's internally cooperative and whatever. Now, that's not to say they don't have moral gods in Japan or somewhere like that. They do. They do have that. They do have large-scale societies and moral gods holding together. But they are more ethnocentric. They are more closely related. They are more, you know, they're more genetically similar to each other. And so that issue, the issue of morality and moral gods becomes less important, and signalling your adherence and signalling your morality is less important because everyone's, you know, genetically quite similar anyway. And so, therefore, what you tend to signal in that society is simply your conformism. It's simply the fact that you conform to whatever the society says you have to do, because it's a highly conformist society. And so you signal your conformity, and you do this through the carrying out of rituals which signal your conformity. Now, once you move away from that, it gets slightly different. If in a society that values, where morality is very, very important, in a society where people are genetically quite distinct and different from each other, and therefore it's the morality that's holding people together, it's the moral gods that hold people together and create, hold society together, you have to signal your morality. You have to signal your adherence to and worship of these moral gods. And that is what you do. And this creates an arms race of morality signalling, of purity signalling, of virtue signalling. And this helps to create explain why what let's call it virtue signalling is such a morality signalling is such a significant part of the history of the West. Now, it's not that it should be emphasised that until relatively recently, this morality was inextricably linked to notions of purity and inextricably linked to the religion. The religion underpinned the Christianity or whatever underpinned the whole system, and so therefore you end up with this spiralling. An example of this is the Reformation. So you have people in the Reformation. You want to gain power in this context, in a context in which people are evolved to regard morality and a person's moral behaviour in the context of that religion as extremely important. What would this mean? It would mean there would be an arms race whereby you would attain power and status and access to resources in a society like that by successfully signalling your adherence to the pro-social, moral God-based religion. And so this would create this arms race of virtue signalling, of religiousness signalling, of purity signalling, and of morality signalling, of signalling the moral aspects of the religion, humility and things like that. And this helps to explain what happened in the Reformation. So in the Reformation, you basically have people who are in the middle of society. They want to, the craftsmen and the merchants and people like that, and they want to attain power. They want to attain the power that the nobility and the aristocracy have. How do they do this? Well, they signal that, oh, I'm so religious, I'm so devout in my belief in God, I'm so humble, I'm so modest, look how modest I am, I'm a Puritan, I wear dark clothes and whatever, I'm so modest, I'm so humble, I'm so moral, I'm so moral, I'm so good. And it creates this race of signalling, and signalling it subtly, signalling it in such a way that it doesn't seem like you're signalling it, it seems like it's genuine. That's interesting as well, because it would mean that if you genuinely believed it, if you genuinely believed you were moral, then people would be more likely to accept that you were. You would be more convincing. And so if you genuinely had this profound sense of guilt and this profound sense of, oh my God, I feel so terrible, oh, I'm so humble and I'm so worthless, and I'm so worthless before God, I'm so humble. If you genuinely felt that, in your really, really felt that, then of course you would come across in this virtue signalling spiral as seeming more genuinely moral, and this would put you at an advantage. And so consequently there would be selection for people to genuinely feel that they were worthless, to genuinely feel that they needed to be really, really moral to vitiate against some sort of imagined original sin or something, and therefore it would make the system even more extreme. And this helps to explain why you get these moral panics over issues such as alcohol, for example, in Scandinavia, over whatever, which are Christian-based and which sweep through the society, in which people, you just virtue signal, and that means you have to virtue signal more and virtue signal more. And so you can see how basically these kinds of people would be selected to be very, very high in virtue signalling. This would be a case to a lesser extent in a society that was easier. So if the society is harsher up to a point where it's so harsh that it can't develop a genius strategy, up to that point, but in that key zone, if it's extremely harsh, what you're going to get is very, very high intergroup competition, very, very extreme fighting for resources. And one of the ways you're going to successfully fight for resources is by virtue signaling and thus attaining status and thus attaining resources. And this is in an environment in which, until relatively recently, until 100, 200 years ago or something, there was a clear association between your access to resources and passing on your genes. The richer 50% of the society had double the completed fertility of the poorer 50% of the society in European societies in the 1600s. So it becomes a way of passing on more of your genes. Now, the system is going to be less harsh, less extreme as you go south, because basic needs are met to a greater extent. Social pressure is weaker, environmental pressure is weaker. And so you would expect people in the south, Italy, Spain, Greece, these sorts of places, to be less prone to virtue signalling, to be less selected to virtue signalling, to be less selected even towards a kind of moral religiousness, because they would need to be held together to a lesser extent, because group selection pressures would be lower, and so there'd be less of this. There'd be less of a need for ethnocentrism, so there'd be less of a need for them to be strongly held together. So there'd be less of a need for very, very strongly moral gods in that kind of environment. And you would expect the need for very, very strongly moral gods that were very obsessed with morality to go up and up and up and up and up as you moved away from this relatively easier environment where you don't need to be that ethnocentric, because you don't need to be held together to that great extent, because there's not as much pressure, to Scandinavia and Britain and places like this, where it would be extreme. And it would be curvy linear, if you like, and then it would go down once you get to places that are extremely harsh, such as Japan and whatever, because they can't develop the genius strategy and therefore they can't develop the focus on morality. And so that's what I think is going on. And that's why I think somewhere, so Scandinavia is so high in wokeness. Now, of course, I would suggest it's probably higher in an ethnocentrism strategy than Britain. I would say Britain is probably the peak Goldilocks zone of this genius strategy. And consistent with that, Britain is hugely, hugely overrepresented. It punches above its weight enormously in terms of its contribution to genius, but in terms of what it's done, in terms of the fact that it's achieved this huge... You know, what genius does is it allows the society to expand. And so think of the size of the British Empire and the success of Britain. That shows you that the genius strategy worked, and Sweden has been less successful. So I would say that Sweden probably has less of a genius strategy. But... well, even though it has less of a genius strategy, it still does have a significant genius strategy, and it combines this, therefore, with the movement in a Japan direction of being highly, highly, highly group K-selected, and therefore, to a greater extent than Britain, with a smaller gene pool and more K-selected, more selected to a harsher environment, more selected for conscientiousness, more selected for selecting out psychopathic traits because they're totally intolerable, and therefore much, much more conformist than Britain, much, much more conformist, and with a lower per capita level of these geniuses, and therefore a lower per capita level of psychopathology, and therefore a lower per capita level of people that are going to rock the boat, people that are going to refuse to conform, people that are going to question the system, people that are going to refuse to take this nonsense. And so what that means is that even though they may be lower in genius strategies than somewhere like Britain, once you get some sort of phenomena, some sort of craze, some sort of moral panic, it is going to sweep through the society with incredible speed. and with an incredible level of extremeness, because in somewhere like Britain, there would be more of these genius types, these non-conformists, these sceptics, these psychopathic type people that would question the system and that would refuse to be sucked in by it and would say no and would be cynical of it and whatever. And they would stand up against this change, and therefore the change would be slowed down and would become less extreme. These people are going to be a lower percentage of the population in somewhere like Sweden. And consequently, even though they might be at the sort of in terms of selection, in a sense, they might be less of a genius strategy, more based on ethnocentrism, even so, because they're more K up to this optimal point with Japan and places like this where they can't operate this kind of strategy at all, then these kinds of things are going to be so conformist, they will sweep through the society. And so consequently, no one will stand up to them, and you will get absolute extreme wokeness. Now, similarly, in Japan, things do sweep through society. They are highly conformist, and you get crazes that sweep through the society. But this has to be balanced with the fact that they are extremely high in ethnocentrism, and therefore it's very difficult for certain kinds of craze to sweep through the society. They are extremely conservative. They are extremely resistant to change. But once the change comes in, then it sweeps through, but and they are extremely resistant to things like multiculturalism because they're so high in ethnocentrism. If they weren't, then you can expect multiculturalism to sweep through the society. But they are resistant to it because they're so high in ethnocentrism. Swedes and Scandinavians are less high in ethnocentrism, and this allows these things to sweep through the society. The British and whatever are even less high in ethnocentrism, but they because of that, they have more geniuses and more psychopaths, and therefore this acts as a bulwark to stop these kinds of moral signalling things sweeping through the society without some people reacting against it. So it seems to me that Sweden is in a kind of Goldilocks zone of wokeness, and we can suggest that the Scandinavians have therefore kind of been selected to be extremely woke. Now, what of course this, as I said, if you have this kind of strategy, this genius strategy, and you have religion, well then it becomes adaptive. Once the religiousness collapses because the level of stress has collapsed, and so therefore people are less religious, or because you have more and more people for various reasons that I've looked at in other videos to do with changes in the genetics of the population, who are less religious and haven't been selected for religiousness, which is highly heritable, about 0.4 to 0.6 heritable, and we were selected for that under Darwinian conditions. Those selection pressures have heavily weakened, so we're no longer selected for it. So you get more and more people that aren't religious, and then they sort of influence the society and push everybody in a less religious direction. Then the society becomes low in religiousness, and it simply has the traits with no religiousness that are associated with the genius system, that is to say, generalised altruism, liking foreigners, cooperation with foreigners, outward looking, high in openness, high in guilt. And of course, what that means is they're going to be very, very, very open to foreigners, and so in that sense, very, very woke. They're going to be very, very, very high in guilt, and so they're going to easily believe that they're worthless and they're useless, and they should allow foreigners in huge numbers to come into their societies, and so they're going to therefore be in serious trouble. I've looked separately at why this is extreme among the Finns, so I won't look at this again. One of them is that they're higher in intelligence, but that's it. That's the difference. Whereas you're going to get in Britain, they're going to be there will be a hold on these ethnocentric flurries. On these virtue signalling flurries because of the higher percentage of people that are high in psychopathic traits, and the level of guilt is likely to be lower. Because the K strategy is slightly lower, and the level of generalized altruism is also likely to be lower because again the K strategy is slightly lower, so the people are less basically sort of kind, and so consequently Scandinavia is the peak, is for that reason likely to be the peak woke. You have a series of different factors: the ethnocentric strategy, the genius strategy, the K strategy, all working together such that Sweden and places like that become the Goldilocks zone for wokeness. And so this is why I think the Vikings are so woke. Well, I hope this is a bit of interest, and if it has, then please do subscribe. It really helps if you do that. If you want to help me, you can see various ways, Patreon, Subscribestar, whatever, that you can help me out below the channel. Remember, I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock UK time. That's to 2 o'clock in New York. And I will see you soon. And goodbye!